The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
When you first wake up in the morning, you don't usually say, "Oh, I'm glad my heart is still beating," but it's a thought because, you know, you had no control over it. A lot of people uncontrollably simply have their heart stop beating, sometimes during their sleep and sometimes in what we call a coronary or a heart attack. The heart's a wonderful muscle, isn't it? It just beats away whether we want it to or not. It's an involuntarily built muscle that simply keeps throbbing away and giving us the very substance of life, whatever that is. We're not sure what life is. Trace it all the way back, and where did it first begin? When did the first heart start beating? Somewhere when things became insects and animals instead of plants. You know, evolution tells a very strange tale. Evolution says there is no God, that you and I, and all creatures for that matter, from single-celled amoeba to the most complex, and that's a strange word because what's simple about an amoeba, the most complex forms of life. They were all supposedly evolutionary products over aeons of indeterminate periods of time that gradually changed and evolved into what we see today. But evolution cannot be proved. Theologians say they can't prove God exists. It's kind of tough to go out and try to sell the world on a book you believe is mostly fake. It's pretty tough for people to go out and say, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God and the salvation to all them that believe." And all the time, you know that the entire weight of science, of this modern space age, of practically every little bit of history you can ever pick up, of all the studies of science, of mathematics, ecology, biology, paleontology, embryology, comparative anatomy, and so on, all make you out some kind of a liar. It's a pretty difficult place to be in, isn't it? To try to sell religion on the one hand when people are so smitten with science today in this modern space age, and on the other hand, religionists who will give in to the scientific claims of evolution, who simply seem not able to go to the book they claim to represent and to find out that book challenges them to prove it one way or the other. You do not have to accept God's existence just on some blind guess. God's own word tells you to prove it one way or the other, if you think it is God's word. And that gets at the heart and the root of the whole thing. This modern day in which we live is a day that is very ecology conscious. Now, ecology is merely a study of the relationship, the interrelationship of living creatures to each other, and of those living creatures in a biosphere, in their own ecosystem, to the physical environment. So, ecology is really a study of this number five, the fifth proof, that there is a divine creator God. I've been going through a series on seven proofs God exists, and the first is law requires to our thinking, rational, logical minds, a lawgiver. The second is that life requires a life giver. The third is that merely by looking at the rocks under your feet, at the heavens above your head, you see there is a creation. Now, you get down to the point here in the book of Isaiah, for example, in the Moffat translation, someone is quoted. Whether you think this was Isaiah, some ancient sage who tried to bring about social reform in his day, this was merely one of the Jewish people who was trying to aggrandize his own race, and therefore you can afford to ignore it or not, I don't know. Whether you think it was merely a reporter who was being used as a human implement or instrument in God's hands and it was God doing the inspiration and the speaking through him might be a good guess, but you don't need to guess. You can prove it one way or the other. Here are the words, though, pretty challenging to skeptics and atheists and agnostics, as well as, believe it or not, to many, a Christian professing person who has simply gone along through life believing in a religion that he accepted because his parents accepted it or because his friends do, but he never got around to really proving it. So the science writer in the newspaper comes along and talks about man running around naked in the earth about 600,000 years ago, dragging women into caves by the hair, and this fellow believes it. You know, I don't know how to reconcile it. The Genesis says, in the beginning, God, and scientist says, in the beginning was a hydrogen atom. Doesn't it kind of bother people once in a while to have all of these monumental, irreconcilable difficulties and never get to the grassroots question one way or the other, never come to grips with the biggest questions of our lives? Who was this then? Was it a God who spoke through, like a reporter, someone he used as a human instrument? It says in Isaiah 40 and verse, let's see, Moffat has here in the margin 25, "To whom will you compare me then and equal me?" asks the Majestic One. "Lift high your eyes, look up, who made these stars?" Now evolution says, look down, Look at the amoeba. Look at green slime or seaweed or brown scum or polka dotted air bubbles in the sea. Or look at extreme heat or extreme cold. They go to every extreme you can imagine. And they say, certainly your mind won't have too much difficulty in imagining all these giant leaps at how what once was just a kind of a plant lying there sluggishly in a primordial soup of methane and noxious ammonia became an insect crawling around with a complete digestive system. And you know, stop to think about a mosquito. What's simple about one of those? I just came back from a little lake. I was up there sitting around in a fishing boat. Didn't do very good, but the mosquito sure did. And every now and then you pick one of those, so you try to follow this thing. They tell you when one's biting, you clench your fist or your arm, and what that does is pull the epidermis and the dermis in a strange way, and it twists his little proboscis, and you got him trapped, or you're leaving him in there in the meantime. You know what that little thing has? He's got an anticoagulant that doesn't allow the blood to clot, and his little beak, his little proboscis, is loaded with all kinds of germs, so the minute he pulls that hickey up in there, it's full of germs, so you scratch it, and that causes more blood to flow, increases the circulation. But he's got a complete digestive system, he's able to fly, he's got fantastic vision, he's got a tremendous smell. Because you can be clear in the middle of the lake when it's evening, and they can smell you, somebody in the pine tree saying, hey, there's a fisherman out there, and they come and they get you. Now, what's simple about an insect? How did an insect come to be out of algae or seaweed? These are the things I've been taking exception to time and time again. Evolution says look down. God says look up. Who made the heavens? There's a challenge in the Bible. It says prove me now herewith. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says prove all things. Romans, the first chapter, I have talked of time and again, says because that which may be known of God is evident to them. Because God has shown it to them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world, by looking at that which is created, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. So that fifth proof is merely design. Now before I forget the fourth one, I went back to show you it's law, lawgiver, life, life giver. The third is the creation itself. The fourth is kind after kind. The fact that there's an operable mechanism. The world itself, the entire solar system, and for that matter, the entire universe. The entire ecosystem then of the universe. The physical environment of this earth, as well as the earth, as well as all living creatures in their myriad forms upon it, are like one giant, pulsating, throbbing, living mechanism that had a beginning and that is gradually running down. So ecology in itself is a study of design. It is a study in perfect harmony. You know, polluted air is not a theory. We get to the point where we begin to scream for legislation to give us clean air. Legislation can't give you clean air. All it can do is avoid dirtying the air. Man can't give you air. God gives you that. Just like man can't give you that wonderful heart muscle that keeps throbbing away. Oh, they've tried transplants. It's a marvelous thing what medical science can do, and sometimes, unfortunately, the operation was a success, but the patient died. It's still a marvelous thing. But even organ transplants are possible, but the point is they can't produce a new one. Now, how did it all get started? Do you ever go back and just kind of pause in your daily rut that we all get ourselves in and ask yourself, how did it all get started and where did I come from? Did I just happen? Am I the result of an accident? Or did I have some real purpose in being here? Is there a great creator being who knows me? Who knows every hair on my head, no matter how few they're getting to be? And who has a purpose for me being here? Should I be looking into a book which might tell me why I'm walking the earth and why I'm using my allotted portion of clean air and when I can get it? It's about time we did. Science can't give you clean air. Science can't give you pure water. The water in the air was here before you and I ever happened along. We entered into a ready-made biosphere. Now this entire biosphere, our entire physical and living and chemical environment, is the study of ecology, and ecology that comes along to tell us about imbalance in population, that we're going to double population by the end of this century, and again in a few more years, and then quadruple it and so on. And we know that that spells absolute disaster. Ecologists are studying then a giant, interwoven, harmonious pattern, a tremendous design. Now we're beginning to exceed those design limits because of many, many mistakes that are being made. Number five, a major proof that God exists is simply design. But design is not simple. Now, in a moment, I'll show you some very spectacular creatures. A woodpecker, and then a little archer fish, and then a little fish that has four eyes, and we'll ponder, as evolution tries to do, because it deals with creatures that live as well as fossil life. It says, look down, look at these creatures, and imagine how it all could have happened. God says, look up to the stars and ask, who made them? But these challenges in the Bible about finding out about God's eternal divinity and His Godhead by looking at that which has been made should be accepted.
Only in the last few decades has man discovered how to take to the air and navigate successfully. Now he flies in all sizes and shapes of aircraft, ranging from homemade hovercraft to supersonic jet fighters and huge airliners. But lonely birds have been flying for thousands of years. The colorful brochure, A Theory for the Birds, takes a fascinating look at the marvels of bird flight and migration, at tiny hummingbirds and huge birds of prey. It explores the unique details of birds from beak to tail feather. In A Theory for the Birds, the woodpecker pokes holes in the theory of evolution. Both you and your children will find it an informative and educational booklet. Request your free copy of A Theory for the Birds. Send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.
What does it take to fly? How does the miracle of flight evolve? You know, the forces that work on an aerodynamically sound body are forces that man merely learns how to get in harness with. He merely learns how to use what has already been built. A man looks at a bird and he sees that birds fly and that insects fly, and some of them are very aerodynamically unsound according to science, like a bumblebee. His power to weight ratio is fantastic, as they could produce an aircraft with a body as huge, proportionate to the tiny wing that flies on a bumblebee. We'd really have some super giant cargo planes that'd be carrying about 10 times what some of them do. But you know, they fly. There are all kinds of creatures that fly. They hover, they soar, they fly backward, they go straight up, they fly in every direction, darting here and there in the insect world, but even birds. They fly a lot more efficiently than aircraft. They migrate better and more accurately than even inertial navigation systems, the computer that took our astronauts to the moon. And they have been doing it from the first moment they ever did it. When did the very first successful migration occur? It had to be successful, or the bird lost his way and didn't get there, and he didn't survive, therefore he doesn't exist. Now, here's the exception I take to it when they tell me in books that I read that the closest living relatives to our alligators and crocodiles today are birds. That kind of puzzles me a little bit. I say, well now, how can that happen? How can the closest living relatives to mosquitoes be elephants? Or, let's say, how can the closest living relatives to a modern jet airplane be an anvil? It doesn't make a bit of sense. But they tell you, you don't have any difficulty in imagining, do you, how some ungainly kind of amphibian was crawling around a rock one day and bumped into a sharp rock and a scale came loose. Now, amphibians basically don't have scales. They've got kind of interwoven armor plates, and if it looks like a scale, like on a snake's body, it isn't really as much as it is a skin. It's not separate scales like on a fish. But they say that a loosely hanging frayed scale evolved into a feather. And that's how birds first began to fly. They see certain reptilian characteristics in Archaeopteryx and other so-called primitive birds. But you know, you look at birds standing around on one leg today, like some of the storks and some of the other birds that we see, the water birds, and they look pretty primitive too. If all you could see of them was fossil life, you'd say, my, what a primitive looking bird. Or like an elephant, you'd say, here was a creature with a tail on both ends. You come up with all kinds of irrational explanations. How did this evolve, if it did? Let's take a look at just one bird as a case in point, the woodpecker. Here's a bird that has to have all kinds of very, very specialized equipment in order to survive. Now, plenty of birds are running around the fields and the trees and the limbs, getting food on the top of the limb, out of the air, at the surface of water, underneath the water, and on the land, and off grass, and so on. But the woodpecker, he gets his in a completely different way by banging his head against a tree all day long. Here's a pileated woodpecker, Now, this woodpecker is fairly large. These can be corrupt to the size of a smaller crow. The first most obvious difference is that bird's beak. That beak is a lot more powerful than most bird beaks. Matter of fact, it's even hooked up to his head by a shock absorber between his beak and his head, like a resilient cartilage material that is completely different from other birds. He's got very powerful neck muscles, all specially adapted to banging away and whacking away at the bark on trees, and even drilling his way completely into a tree for his nest. Now here he knows with his acute hearing that there's some bugs inside of there. He can't see them, but when he bangs, he can hear them crawling around and screaming at one another, whatever it is they're doing. Now, he's got a long, tipped, sticky tongue. It has barbs on the end of it. It looks like a red worm. Sometimes they'll even put it in there and let it lie a minute. The ants will attack it and think it's a worm. His claws are shaped just about like ice tongs. They're gripper claws, different from other birds, more powerful. He can walk up or sideways, around or down on that tree. His tail is very stiff and very short. He uses it like a tripod. And it's very helpful to this bird that that tail molts, that is, he loses the feathers on it and replaces them, gradually, one at a time. If they all fell out suddenly, of course he'd try to prop his rear end against a tree, there wouldn't be anything there, he'd tumble over backwards and break his neck. How much wood would a woodpecker peck if a woodpecker would peck wood? That's the question that is asked and answered in this colorful brochure. You can have it by return mail if you'll write for it. I'll give you the address at the close of the program, so be sure to jot it down. Get a pen or a pencil handy and write for it. You'll want your children to see these pictures that graphically illustrate how these creatures could not have evolved, that their food-getting apparatus, their method for survival, had to work the very first time the first woodpecker pecked wood, and had to work just as perfectly as it works right now. There never was a halfway woodpecker which didn't really peck wood, or else he had a broken beak, a sprained neck, a migraine headache, ruffled and broken and bent tail feathers, and probably awfully stiff feet. I've often wondered, you know, about birds after a heavy windstorm that didn't talk to each other and say, man, I got cramps in my feet last night because hanging onto those limbs. But, you know, woodpeckers have a different kind of feet that can clench on just like a couple of ice tongs, and they've got no problem with it. They're specially adapted, specially designed to do precisely what they do. I want you to see now another very, very large headache for evolutionists. And first, let me show you why it's a headache. This is a little fish, and he's called an archer fish. Now, ichthyologists have discovered that archer fish are completely different from any other fish in the entire fish world. He's only one example out of more than 1,300,000 catalog species on this earth. And in every one of those 1,300,000 cases, there's a special, interesting life story. In every case, there are special methods of nest building, of protection through camouflage, of coloration, of mating and breeding, of migrating, of food-getting techniques. Every creature has a different method for survival. But there's something unique about this archer fish I want to show you in just a few moments, and that is that this amazing ability, this amazing food-getting apparatus, is not necessary for his survival. And that's a real headache for evolution. The archer fish is a fish you can go buy. If you live in one of the large cities, you could probably get one of these little creatures for your own home fish tank or aquarium, and you might have a lot of fun with him. I've done this before because a long time ago we did one entire telecast on the subject of the archer fish when we first got the pictures that were so painstakingly achieved by sitting there for days and days to get everything just right in this fish tank where this archer fish would take a pot shot at a captured insect we had affixed to a leaf overhead. But the question for evolution is this. The archer fish is specially equipped just like the woodpecker. He's different. He swims underneath and he'll feed there. He'll feed on the surface. He will even leap free of the surface to feed, just like other fish do. So he does not need this amazing ability to shoot a spray of water. Sometimes a big male up to 15 feet, some of them can do that, and they've even put out cigarettes to people who approach the tank at night that were studying them, ichthyologists and the like. So they're called Toxotes jaculatrix, which merely means ejaculator fish of the genus Toxotes, and that's nature's version of the Polaris submarine. They are indigenous to coastal brackish swamps around Southeast Asia and even out of the northern coast of Australia. Mostly in Southeast Asian waters, it's a very tiny fish. It attains a maximum length of about 7 inches, but that's a big one. Now, the archer fish has very very wide eyes. He's equipped with binocular vision, just like you and me. That means that though his eyes are obviously separated on each side of his head, he can swivel them slightly forward so he sees only one image. He's not looking at two things at once like a cow or a rabbit. And when he is swiveling them around, he can see and solve the problem of underwater light bending, like refraction of light rays. Sometimes if you have a home swimming pool, or you can get into a neighbor's pool or go to a public pool or something, and you like to swim with a face mask, go down and take a look up and see what you can see. And you'll find it's a very, very narrow amount of vision that you have. And you can't see laterally very far at all. You can see basically in a circle just about straight up. The archerfish doesn't have that problem. Somehow he's overcome it. The question is how? Now, not only this, but he has a groove in the roof of his mouth, a hard, bony tongue, and by snapping his gill plate shut, he can ejaculate a stream of water with deadly accuracy. So as these little fish develop, they begin spitting from the time they're born, and gradually numerous targets above the water in their natural habitat take their attention. They might shoot that jet out only an inch or two at first, or a few inches, and finally up to about 22 inches becomes common. So ichthyologists have discovered this fish has a remarkable ability, but they've also proved he does not need this remarkable ability in order to survive. Is it just an acquired characteristic? If so, why aren't Hebrew babies born circumcised? If acquired characteristics are passed on to successive generations, how come human beings, men, don't have all kinds of characteristics that have been passed down? Well, take the biblical argument some people come up with. How come men aren't born with one rib short? Well, of course, a lot of people don't believe that story in the book of Genesis, but it's still a valid question. Acquired characteristics simply are not passed on all that much. And some very slight characteristics may be, but not major changes such as that. And wild leaps from one kind to another simply do not occur in nature. I want to show you another remarkable example, and that's a fish that has four eyes. Two sets of eyes to look up and two sets of eyes to look down. A remarkable example of what people like to call nature with a capital N, and another very large headache for evolutionists. If this evolved, how did it?
A nation is only as strong as its family. If our nation were as strong as your family, how strong would it be? And if relationships in your family are not what you would like, where can you go for help? Plain Truth, a publication of understanding, is concerned. Every Plain Truth brings you helpful articles on how relationships can be strengthened between husband and wife, parents and children, families and neighbors. With interesting and useful information on helping your child enjoy learning at home and school, budgeting and sensible use of credit, preventing teenage depression, household health and safety, homemaking tips for the working mother, achieving full human potential, coping with inflation. Plain Truth emphasizes quality in all aspects of daily living. Let Plain Truth help strengthen your family and nation. Send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.
Anna Blepp's little four eyes, with two eyes capable of seeing above the water and two capable of seeing anything that might approach from underneath, is a big headache for evolutionists. An unusual number of rods and cones, and you know that upper cornea attached to the lower retina and vice versa is another headache. Now, it's not, as some people might suppose, just one eye that is divided by some piece of skin. Those are separate, totally different eyes, and all of them function. Now, how on earth could such a marvelous mechanism have evolved gradually? If it's a means to escape, it's not a means, certainly, of recognition of each other. There's nothing beautiful about it, you can say that. It's not colorful. It's not something that could just happen. You don't swim around and then someday suddenly find another eye developing on top of your present eyes. This is something that is absolutely, technically, intricately developed and functions perfectly right now. And the point is, it had to function perfectly the first time it ever did. There couldn't have been any halfway measure. There are so many vast problems with the theory of evolution. I couldn't begin to cover them. If I were doing a half-hour straight talk program for 10 solid years in a row, 5 times a day, I simply could not. The missing intermediate species, the entire study of strata or stratigraphy, the story of fossil life, the entire food chain. You write for these colorful brochures we've shown you, and see some of the humor in it, too. I think it's about time God got some equal time with evolutionists. These are a theory for the birds and some fishy stories about an unproved theory. Now, the reason we call it a theory for the birds is because of the obvious facetious intent there. But as well as that, here's a theory about how the closest living relatives of our birds are crocodiles. I don't believe it for a minute, and I believe that science disproves it. True science and your Bible are not in conflict whatsoever. They're in absolute harmony. Now, these brochures don't ask you to join anything. You're under no obligation. No one's going to come knocking on your door and saying, "Now, we've got your address. Just wait till you see what we've got to sell you." It just will not happen. They're free of charge, a free educational service in the public interest, and they do talk about the Bible. This brochure, A Theory for the Birds, is not just technical scientific information. It is simplified. It can be understood by any level, all the way from children to very, very aged and elderly. It's something you'll want to read. It's absolutely free. And this brochure and this magazine, the Plain Truth Magazine, have an awful lot to do with your own private and personal life. You bet you don't say when you wake up in the morning, "Oh, I'm glad my heart is still beating." You take it for granted. I challenge you. You take your hand and place it right now on your chest on the left side. And you feel that heart beating in there, and you tell yourself, "How did that evolve? How did that wonderful muscle by itself evolve out of seaweed? How did I become to be? Look at me. Look at my hands, at my feet, at my body, at my eyes and my ability to see, my ability to hear, my ability to think and to reason, what my mind can do, my concept of the appreciation of colors or of music." Ask yourself, what is a laugh? Why do people who speak completely different languages, maybe Japanese, Greek, English, or something else, all laugh alike? But laughter is the same in any language. Why do we have the ability to enjoy music? And why, even though taste in music differs, does salt taste identical for everybody? Why, when you sit around and describe it, even though you speak a different language, do vegetables taste exactly the same way to a Japanese person as they do to a black American, and the same way to a Chicano American as they might to somebody in Germany? Why do we have these same tastes? Why are we made the way we are? You need to get started on finding out about yourself. And the way to do it is to ask whether or not you evolved, or whether or not what your Bible says about humankind, about our purpose for being on this earth, and about where we're going to go, is just mythology, or whether it is true. Now, that brochure, A Theory for the Birds, A Tale for the Birds, is an obvious, easy, simple, plain, straight from the shoulder, rational explanation. It is not deep and technical and scientific. It's not over anybody's head.
All you need to do to receive this brochure is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that, if you would, please. The call letters of your radio station. While you're at it, why don't you request the current number of the Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And that's what you will read in the Plain Truth. It is Plain Truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.